It's the heavy election edition of Radio Free Thinker. On this week's show, we have election reality checks, feedback, and a special treat. Post-thinker Rob is back in town. Now let's start with episode 112.
It's amazing to consider that I'm holding in my hands the place where someone once felt, thought, and loved. For centuries, scientists have been battling to understand what this unappealing object is all about.
Here is this massive jelly you can hold in the palm of your hand, and it can contemplate the vastness of interstellar space.
The brain has evolved from the inside out.
Its structure reflects all the stages through which it has passed.
Information in the form of energy streams in simultaneously through all of our sensory systems. In the form of energy.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course also heard in Kamloops on CFBX. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher, and we have some special treats in the audience, in the studio.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and recent English immigrant.
And this is Daniel, now vice president of UBC Freethinkers.
Ooh. Rob, I hear you've lost your clock or something. You've been unhinged from time with all this jet setting between here and there.
Actually,
and
I've
everywhere.
Been time traveling all over. No, it's just I'm in that wonderful transition period between proper jet lag, when I am really just 8 hours ahead and know, like, you know, my body knows what time it is, and now that time where my body has absolutely no clue what time it is, and I'm running on basically coffee.
That I thought Mythbusters did a whole show about how you can't actually walk on water or coffee. It's coffee, maybe a very thick coffee.
No, you can run on it, and especially if it's very thick coffee.
Also, you're in Britain. Why not tea?
Yeah.
You'd be surprised how little tea people actually drink there. And the sort of coffee that I've gotten used to is the really awful stuff that they have in the department canteen. You know, The sort of like Sainsbury's super blend, you know.
And Sainsbury, for those who don't know, has nothing to do with sanity. It's just the brand. But Rob, so you've been in England and you've been doing researchy stuff. And what have you been up to?
Yeah, well, London is huge. It doesn't quite get drilled into you even over here of how large and massive London is. Not just like scale wise, but. In the amount of opportunities that you have there. Like, I go out to the pub and oh, look, I'm talking with someone who works for BBC News, and now I'm going to class, and oh, look, it's a guy whose papers I was reading when I was an undergraduate. It's crazy. Like, it's like London is where the entire world just decided to all hang out one day, and they stayed.
Cool.
What have you learned?
The courses I've been taking at UCL have been in decision making and reasoning. So when I was here at UBC, I focused on attention and awareness and how people's vision works and how they pay attention to the world around them. And I wanted to bone up on more about how people make decisions and how reasoning works. So UCL is one of the world renowned programs for this kind of thing, and it's been really cool learning about how irrational people really are.
Well, speaking of irrational people, what can you tell us about the upcoming wedding of the century?
So, for those who don't know, Kate and Wills are getting married, and it's the fantastic royal wedding, and they've basically shut down the entire city so that they can take over and have, you know, fleets of horses and impressive music and all that stuff. But most people that I hang out with sort of are taking it in stride as a, well, you know, whatever. And you should see the kitschy junk that they're selling. Like, all the street vendors have come out in droves, and they have T-shirts and commemorative plates and stuff, like mugs and umbrellas and anything you can think of, just emblazoned with cheap iron-on pictures of Will and Kate and the royal seal that they came up with them. But what I like is there are other people that are setting up beside these vendors and selling things that say stuff on them, like, thanks for the free day off.
Actually, I'd heard somewhere that there was a movement to get rid of the royal seal and replace it with the royal penguin. Is that... So you said you did some... You're doing research into irrational behavior and rational studies, and what else have you, like, can you enlighten us with anything you may or may not have learned about?
So, it's kind of an amusing story. I don't know if how many people have seen the talk that I gave just before I moved to London. It was The Lying Brain. And one of the last things I talked about was this research in something called choice blindness, where what happens is that you give a person a choice of preference between two different things, like, for example, two pictures of people. Which one of these do you prefer, a blonde or a brunette? You point to the brunette. I use some magician's sleight of hand to change to the one that you actually rejected. I hand it to you. So if you chose the brunette, I hand you the blonde. And then I ask you, all right, so here's the one you chose. Why'd you choose her? And you give a plausible, rational reason for doing so. Now, this research is done by Petra Johansson, who's a postdoc, who it turns out is at UCL. And I gave this talk several times and talked about it on my blog and used his name and the words change blindness. And he has a Google alert that pings him every time someone uses the term. So when I came to the UCL and I saw that he was on the faculty list there, I was like, great, great, I'm going to, you know, ask him if he can be my master supervisor. And he already knew who I was when I came in to see him.
Was this him suing for copyright infringement?
Happily, he liked what I was doing with it, and he's now my master supervisor, and we're developing some follow-up studies to the change blindness paradigm. Because since then, he's done a lot of different replications of it. He's done it with not just preference for images, but also preference for tastes and smells of jam and tea. But also, really interestingly, he did it with people's moral judgments. So you could move people's moral judgments around. Like, here's a situation: is this moral or not? And they say yes or no, and you change their answer to the opposite, and then ask them to justify it, and they give a completely plausible reason for this view that is completely opposing to the one they had before. And very recently, just last year, Sweden had a general election coming up, and he changed people's election voting intentions and got them to come up with reasons to vote for the party that they initially didn't want to vote for.
That sounds like election tampering.
But no, Rob, I'm going to have to back it. No, I can see, you know, people changing their mind sort of about the taste of jam or their preference for tea. But morals, we have learned from the church that morals go beyond reality. That there's a firm foundation, or at least if you're more like myself, you think there's scientific foundations for this. How can you whittle away at one of the most important things that makes us human?
Well, I'm going to go with the evidence that I have seen for myself, as opposed to the evidence that people purport to say they feel very strongly about. But one reason that we think this kind of reasoning happens is that all of these situations have a certain subjective element to them. Preference for images or tastes, that's pretty obvious. Moral judgments, there is still an element of subjectivity because people aren't really sure that there is an objective morality that's possible. And also with political opinions, there's also a bit of objectivity to that because it's really hard to judge how a particular political viewpoint works based on the evidence. So what could be happening here? There's this one philosopher, Dan Sperber, who thinks that reasoning evolved not as a mechanism which we use to come up with decisions, but rather as a way of convincing other people. So all that's really happening is that some unconscious process comes to a decision, and then when someone asks you, why'd you choose it, you come up with reasoning to convince them of why that was a good choice. So the research in change blindness sort of supports the idea that, well, it's not really reasoning and then decision. It's something else decision, and then the reasoning comes to support it afterwards, after you already know what that decision is. But one thing that we're trying to look at is, so far this has only been shown in the realm of something that has a subjective element. So my master's thesis is on looking at what happens if you change people's answers to questions that do have prescriptively correct answers, like logic problems or test questions that do actually have a real answer.
How many people actually will tell the experimenter that, no, that's not actually what my decision was? Because it sounds like you sort of just sort of shove in their face, okay, you said this, justify. Doesn't anyone realize that's not what they...
There is about a 30 to 40% detection rate. But that's still a rather large proportion of people that really do not catch on that you've changed their answer.
Well, speaking of changing answers, you have an election coming up, and I think some of this research could fit nicely with our discussions on election news.
Well, yeah, you know, there is a place where this... for those of us who are on the left and have been recently looking at the polling results, we've been going, woohoo, things seem great. Depending on the poll that you're looking at, the NDP has, for the first time in a generation, been ahead of the Liberals. Yet, of course, no two polls sort of say the same thing. In fact, if you factor in the ideas of margin of errors and all that, things haven't really changed all that much, but yet they seem to have changed quite a bit.
Yeah, so, there seems to be a lot of really different polling companies around that all have conflicting answers.
Well, you know, there are several issues that actually come up in the modern polling situation. I mean, first, and actually one of the biggest ones that polling companies have been trying to deal with is to get a balanced group. I mean, for any of the statistical methods to work effectively, you need to have sort of the average Canadian view, and that's becoming harder and harder to do. Most polling companies rely on landline phones, but with modern societies, actually the majority of people now use cell phones. There's almost a 2-to-1 ratio of cell phones to landlines out there. And because they rely on landline numbers, you're actually getting a very...
That's a really biased sample.
Yeah, well, considering, too, the people who tend to have landlines now tend to be older, tend to be rural, tend to be more conservative. And you add into that sort of amplifies the effect, is that people just are too busy or they're too disengaged to take 20 minutes of their time to fill out one of these polls. Going back to the 70s, they had about a 70 to 80% participation rate of people who phoned. Now it's down to 15%. And again, that's very hard for them
15?
To...
15?
1-5.
Holy shit.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
Nothing.
And then, of course, you know, so you don't have a balanced group, which means the polls start to become dubious in themselves. Then you get the other issue of a feedback loop. I mean, thanks to social media, the internet, the polls are much more easier to get a hold of, and a lot more of them out there. But there comes a point when you have to ask, is the poll actually measuring people's opinions, or is it driving people's opinions? You know, in the United States, there's this big phenomenon called push polling. Push polling is not really intended to measure people's response, but to actually persuade them. So depending on the kind of question, they'd sit there and they'd say, well, if you heard that your... opponent A is in favor of raping little children, would you support him? And of course you go, oh, no. And then the next question or down the list, you sit there and say, so, who are you going to vote for down the list? Well, and again, Rob, you could probably play into this. Once you kind of prime people's psychology to be sort of negative against a particular thing, because remember, he said, if this person had, right? And that was one of the things. It's all hypothetical, so you can't call them on it. That you actually start, you know, shaping people's views.
That's a massive framing effect.
Yes. Actually, some of them have been almost that gross in the States, but most of them are more subtle.
Jeez.
Are you in favor of policies that will lose jobs for the country by increasing corporate tax rates? You know, well, framed that way, no. But lastly, and actually you kind of got into this too, Rob, is polling companies, they're a business, right? And political polls actually don't make any money. They've been referred to as lost leaders. But they do help elevate the pollster's visibility and therefore their ability to get corporate clients. But there are several distortions that can happen because of this market sort of drive for them. Pollsters may not want to alienate a client, so we'll attempt to publish polls that are corporate friendly in their result. So, again, depending on what questions you use, the order you use them, again, you're no longer quite creating a balanced poll, but you're driving it. And you might want to do this.
Seems like a bizarre way of thinking about it, because why would, I mean, if the polling company really truly is just finding out what other people's opinions are, why should the corporations that they're going to work for care? Because those people have nothing to do with them.
But again, I mean, one, why would they care? Well, we have, cap and trade or carbon tax and all that, right? Well, those are very vital issues. And if you're a pollster company who consistently sort of helps out their side, they're more willing to see you as one of their kind or more friendly towards them.
Has there ever been any, studies into this, trying to relate what poll companies do for political polls with their corporate clients?
Actually, Greg, one of the Ad Issue members who's in charge of Ipsos Reid, he's the one who's come out and said quite a lot about this and how he sees it as one of the disturbing sort of trends in the industry. Another thing, too, that comes up in sort of the same idea is that there will be a desire for a pollster company to overemphasize shifts in opinion because, the more bigger the shift is, it's like, oh, look at this here, Ipsos Reis Gallup polls, and their name gets out there. Same thing by having...
Whether or not those shifts in opinion are actually significant or
exactly.
Not.
You know, the same thing having lots and lots of polls out there. Again, the more time your name brand is out there, the more free advertising you're getting. So, essentially, there's a lot of problems with listening and looking at the polls, and although they're kind of great as far as, following fake trends, their reliability in these days is becoming more and more questionable.
Well, why don't we go to a break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll come back and we'll look at our own poll.
Which is very reliable.
Very reliable and completely objective. Stay tuned, folks.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
The third annual Dancing Bear Music Festival is taking place Saturday, April 30th at Quest University in Squamish. Nonprofit and organized completely by students, this year's lineup features John and Roy, Brastronaut, Topless Gay Love Techno Party, Humans, and more. Local vendors, a children's area, and tie-dyeing promises fun for the whole family. Tickets are $15 for students, $20 general admission, and $25 at the door. Tickets are available at Zulu Records and High Life Records. To check out other ticket locations or to purchase tickets online, find Dancing Bear Music Festival on Facebook or visit dancingbearmusicfestival.com.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're talking about polls, elections, election days coming up.
And bizarre results.
Indeed.
Ethan, did we get any more returns from our patented skeptic election questionnaire?
We did. I sent out an email to all the candidates reminding them that, election day is coming up. If you haven't responded yet, take a few minutes, take a look at our questionnaire. And we got two responses. One was from Kimball Carew of the Vancouver Kingsway in the Communist Party of Canada. And we also got another response from a candidate who's actually running in Ontario. Now, I'm not sure how they got the...
Oh, Ethan, we know exactly. Radio Free Thinker has become such a phenomenon in the entire internet.
Sure.
That people all over the world are listening. In fact, I may be wrong in this, but I think we did get some results back from David Cameron, from Angela Merkel. maybe I dreamt that.
Yeah.
Either that or there's some kind of communist hive mind, and they all know.
Well, the candidate in Toronto was Andy Carlo of the Marxist-Leninist Party. I think her party leadership must have filtered the questions through, which, if they did, I commend them for that, and we'll put that up on our blog. But let's go into the Vancouver candidate, Mr. Carew of Vancouver Kingsway. Let's review his answers, shall we? So for the first question, Canada is a Christian nation. He strongly disagrees with that sentiment, which is
surprising for a communist.
Yeah, sure, why not? Number two, religious belief should be legally protected from ridicule. He disagrees, so not strongly, but just, he disagrees with that. Not strongly, though. For question three, complementary and alternative medicine, such as naturopathy, etc., should be given equal support in our public health care system. He is neutral on, which I guess is a fair position to have if you're not informed on it. For question four, childhood vaccination should be mandatory. He strongly agrees with that sentiment, which is good for public health.
Yep.
For question five, law enforcement should be barred from employing psychics investigations. Strongly agrees. Well done. For question six, the evidence for alien visitation is overwhelmingly positive. Strongly disagrees. So he at least is up to speed on the UFOlogy department. For question seven, science is just one way of knowing. He strongly disagrees, which is good, because that is what we said, a gotcha question.
Yep.
He got that one. For question eight, scientists who work for the government should not be curtailed or censored in any way if they want to take their findings to the public. Strongly agrees, which again, we thought who would disagree with that. So far, no one has. Number nine, human beings have evolved over time in a random process absent of any control or design by a higher power. Strongly agrees. And finally, the age of the Earth is around 4 billion years old. Strongly agrees.
Excellent.
So, all in all, he sounds a lot less nutty than the Green Party candidates.
Well, I did a bit of a scorecard just to compare them all, right? And as far, if this was like a grade for finals or something, right? Shaw, who was of the Green Party, got 15%. Roy, also of the Green Party, got 25%. And Cario, the one we were just talking about,
that's right,
scored like 90% on our
thing. He passes on the skeptical scientific
with an A.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's great. We kind of said in the beginning, we're not really trying to get the politicians to score points with us. We actually want to hear what they generally have to say. And again, we equally don't want them to send us these questions so we can make fun of them or something. We want to hear what they have to say because these are, in fact, important issues. And no one is talking about this. Well, we hear a lot about families and family values and how the politicians care about our families, which is so sweet of them. But, you know, it'd be great if they focused on like hospitals and roads and stuff too.
Yeah, no, actually, we also were talking on the last show, and I don't know if you guys have an opinion on this, Robert Daniel, but that when you become more and more of a quote-unquote credible candidate, because as much as I may or may not support the Communist or Marxist Party of Canada, odds are they're never going to win a seat, at least not in the near future, and if they do, it's going to be a freak. But as you become more and more of a credible candidate, you can't be as out there with your views because you may alienate a significant part of your electorate.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, all it takes is like someone hearing one opinion of yours that they disagree with, might just turn their vote away from you.
It's a big regression to the mean. You have to appeal to as many of the voting population as you can, and often that means sort of taking the teeth out of your point of view, even when there is something that you very strongly feel about.
Yeah, but I think that contributes to this, you know, voter apathy, and that everybody thinks, oh, they're all the same. Why should I vote? Which is the most dangerous position to have. Sadly, I think, you know, politicians, they're sort of losing their gumption. They're so concerned about getting elected that they honestly, you know, I don't see why they feel they need to be elected, because they don't have any, you know, credibility to say this is what I stand for.
Well, you know, some people got a few good shots in during the last English debate.
Yeah.
Like what? Name one of them.
Jack Layton skewered Ignatieff on his 70% absence record on votes in Parliament, to which Iggy just sort of sputtered and went, while Layton, you know, gave that beautiful creepy uncle grin, and Iggy went on to talk about, well, yeah, but Stephen Harper is the first president to ever be in contempt.
But, you know, maybe this plays into an interesting dichotomy between what Ethan's saying and you're saying. Okay, so he didn't show up for a lot of votes, which I admit is not a very good thing. But at the same time, no one has mentioned that he came out in favor of the Iraq War, right? And that he's all in favor of Canadian militarism abroad, right?
No,
his Empire Light thesis.
Yeah.
I definitely do agree that they just aren't, they don't use them fighting words as often as they could.
No, and I think that's one of the things that you have, you know, comes up, is that we often easily get sidetracked by things that are relatively unimportant. In fact, and I'm throwing this off in the head, when you were talking about change blindness, right? Does any of this play into how people can easily be dissuaded by minor things to make major changes in their opinions without even really realizing that they're doing it?
People can get distracted a lot by really salient, really, really strongly available pieces of information. So if something gets a lot of media coverage, you focus your attention on that, and everything else sort of goes away. I guess by analogy, it's the sort of thing where most people think that flying by plane is really, really dangerous, when way, way more people die every year by being hit by cars, or even, you know, cancer from smoking cigarettes. It's just that the media covers plane crashes way more saliently. So in the same way that if a government wants to spin direction away from some issue that is disfavorable to them, they can focus on something really salient and get a lot of media coverage about something that really ultimately is wrong or doesn't matter, but does the job.
Of course, that leads into another interesting thing that skeptics have to be quite aware of, is you mentioned media coverage, and you know, we have a very undiverse media environment here. And in not necessarily even with politics, but with any of the issues that we cover. I mean, if you are a regular reader of the Georgia Strait, you will have a very biased view about alternative medicine, and not necessarily a good one. And as a good skeptic, you should be out there actively trying to find some other sources of information to gain a certain degree of balance.
Now, possibly this is a bit off topic, but I haven't been reading the Strait since I moved to London. Is Sonia McLeod still writing a column or anything on there?
Sort of. She appears irregularly. The worst situation with Miss McLeod is that her blog continually spouts incredible pseudoscience. Recently, with the nuclear problem in Japan, talking about, you know, you got to buy iodine pills, and I think recently I actually wrote something about homeopathy. Again, is so much better and safer than vaccines, so don't worry about them, type stuff. And I mean, I've sent in comments to the Georgia Strait. I've commented on her blog. They get deleted. I've blogged about her many times, and at this point, she's a lost cause. She, you know, I think Stephen Novella made a comment about Oprah that at a certain point, your pure misinformation and your lack of due diligence on research is now indistinguishable from like criminal neglect. You are promoting something to the hazard of the health of the public. And it doesn't matter if you think it's true or if you're convinced or you just haven't done the research. At this stage, you're just being a menace to the health of people around you.
Yeah. And just to possibly bring it back around to voting and information, that same idea could go for a healthy democracy. One of the assumptions of sort of the democratic ideal is that your electorate is well informed, not that they're misinformed or not that they're uninformed entirely, that they know what their preferences are and that they know which parties best suit those preferences. But this often isn't the case because of things like media misinformation or focusing on only salient stories to
the lack of parties.
The lack of parties. I mean, considering that we're in Canada and we have a fairly good proliferation of parties compared to some other.
Well, there's two parties that are generally considered electable.
Yeah,
maybe three.
I'd say that three that actually get media coverage, as opposed to the two that get anything in the States, for example.
And ironically enough, and this bugs me so much in a way, because everyone, you know, points to the Bloc and how they're a traitor to this country, and sure, great, and how Quebec is so un-Canadian, and I don't know if I quite, because if you think about it, the only province in this country where there's actually going to be a four-party race is going to be in Quebec. I mean, you have the Bloc, the Liberals, Conservatives, and now the NDP. All there are going to be a number of constituencies where they all have a very good chance, which I don't think is going to be replicated anywhere else in the country. You might get three in BC, you know, that where you get the NDP, Liberal, and Conservatives. Most of the other places, as Daniel points out, is going to be one or the other.
Yeah, a lot of places are really down to like two, like Conservatives and Liberals, or Conservatives and NDP, depending on where it's at.
Yeah.
Except maybe Elizabeth is riding.
A possibility. Why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with more election skeptical news stuff here on Radio Free Thinker.
This is Phil Plate of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended. intended.
April 28th at the Biltmore, it's the Sun Wizard LP release party featuring Slam Dunk and High Drops. Get your tickets at Zulu, Red Cat, High Life, Scratch, and if you live in Victoria, Ditch Records. You can also get them online at ticketweb.ca. Don't miss the Sun Wizard LP release party featuring Slam Dunk and High Drops, April 28th at the Biltmore Cabaret. Doors at 8, show at 9:30. This event is proudly presented by Timber.
And we're back now. Now, as most people who've listened to Radio Freethinker, usually we kind of divide our show up into two segments. We kind of have the first half of the show where we talk a lot about, you know, small things, about several different topics. And the second half we sort of save for one big, long topic. Because the next episode comes one day after the election, we thought this week we'd change things a little bit, and we're going to do a bit more about election issues and a bit more about things dealing with the election. Because of what we have been just talking about an informed electorate, and seeing we happen to have England's leading scholar on the issue, no, not quite, but leading scholar in our studio on the issue, Rob, you were talking about how people make informed or uninformed decisions.
Yeah, so there's like I was saying, that assumption that the electorate is informed, but a fairly consistent finding by pollsters and experimental researchers and survey results, even since the 50s, is that the public actually knows dick all about the you know, some people don't even know what party is controlling the House. So given that there's this lack of information about political parties and who's in power and what they do and what their mandates are, does this have an effect on voting? One way of looking at this is this ignorance rational? Do you need an informed electorate in order to have good voting? So some people think that the answer to this question is no, that people don't actually need to be completely informed in order to vote well. They just need to have consistent preferences.
Is this leading to the idea of what they call group sourcing or crowdsourcing, where you mentioned before that one of the things we do isn't so much to rationalize our opinions, but to convince others, with the idea that whatever the group consensus is will ultimately be sort of the best decision, irrespective of whether it was well thought out to begin with.
Yeah, and actually that's one thing that's been put forth since the 1750s by Condorcet, who you may know as the originator of Condorcet-style voting. But his idea,
which we all do.
Talked about it maybe last year when we were talking about the STV and we were talking about different voting systems. But the point is that one of his ideas has turned into what we call aggregate voting. So the idea being that, okay, so some of the electorate isn't all that informed and they will make mistakes when they're voting and vote for a party that doesn't actually support their ideals. But the other side will do the same thing, and so these mistakes will average out, and you'll essentially get a proper style of voting in the aggregate. So the errors that one side will make will be balanced out by the errors that the other side make, and ultimately you'll get the right proportion of results that matches the preferences in the public.
This is a pretty common assumption for many things like economics or social sciences in general, but does it work for elections?
That's the thing. So is this true? And the problem is that knowledge isn't evenly distributed throughout different party supporters. So the kind of voters that usually support liberals versus the kind of voters that usually support NDP versus conservative, etc., have different levels of knowledge about what their party supports and how voting works and things like that. And this means that they're going to make different amounts of mistakes in different directions. So the assumption that their mistakes will average out, and because everyone will make the same amount and they'll be in opposing directions depending on who they're voting for, doesn't hold. And indeed, this is supported by all sorts of research into the amount of knowledge that people hold and how they vote since the 60s, I think. So one assumption that aggregate voting will hold, that doesn't work. So another thing is that, okay, well, maybe people don't actually need to know all that much about their parties in order to vote, not because they'll be fixed in the aggregate vote, but because they use shortcuts. They use what behavioral scientists call heuristics. So you know basically what kind of policies the Conservative Party is going to have economically and socially. So you can always vote Conservative because you know that that's the kind of thing you're going to get. You know what to expect based on, you know, what the candidate looks like or what the party colors are or that sort of thing. So people use shortcuts to vote. But a lot of people think that, well, using these kinds of heuristics, again, is based on the amount of information the voters have. So people with more information about what the party supports and how they fit with their own beliefs are going to use heuristics more accurately.
So with the idea that in the United States that Republicans are always for smaller government, people just know that's part of their... Even though if you actually look at the policies they've actually implemented and done, it's been the exact opposite. But if you're doing a sort of clan identification, you can actually get steered quite wrong in your assumptions.
Well, even the names, right? Conservative, liberal. You assume that's going to mean certain things. But you look at, you know, British Columbia's provincial politics. We have two parties, the NDP and the Liberals. But the Liberal Party is by far from being liberal. They're more like the Conservatives.
And the same thing with the NDP. When I moved to this province, I was so struck at how conservative for a socialist, quote-unquote socialist party, the NDP was. It was like everything had been shifted to the right.
Yeah.
So based on the fact that these two assumptions both fail because it matters how much information the voters have, there's a couple of political scientists from MIT, Margolis and Fuller. They've just published this in the Social Science Research Network on April 5th. They did some research where they developed a model of how much information should affect the way that people are voting, and then they did some experimental tests to see if this held. So the basic idea was that the amount of information is going to change the probability that you vote incorrectly. And where an incorrect vote is defined as voting for a party that is further away to matching your preferences than one of the other parties.
You're using the term information. How would you define information in the context of this?
In this context, so say that you have a list of beliefs, like I'm in favor of choice for abortions, in favor of welfare, or you know, those two things. You can look at the party platforms and on a scale of 0 to 10, rate how much in favor or not in favor they are of a particular policy. And information here is how close the party's platform is on those ratings to your own ratings of how important those policies are.
Isn't that confusing how much they agree with you as opposed to how much information you have knowing that that's their position?
Well, the information is whether you have the knowledge of what their position on that policy is or not.
So how accurately your belief in what they stand for correlates with their actual stance on an issue.
Yeah. So the further those two numbers are apart, the less information you have about the party.
But wouldn't it be more accurate not to go with their sort of party platform, but with, like, their history as a political entity? I mean, every political platform is going to be overwhelmingly like, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do this.
Well, the way that they that these researchers defined the numbers on their platforms wasn't just by what they said in their platforms, but by voting behavior. In for example, like the partisan breakdown of votes in the Senate. This was done in the states. So they would, you know, use the breakdown of who voted for what to create the split of the numbers.
Okay.
And the basic idea was that based on how much information or uncertainty you had, there was a sort of continuum between 0.5 and 0 for the probability that you would vote incorrectly. So you either vote 0.5, which is you have it's complete chance whether you're going to vote for the correct party that is closest to your beliefs, to 0, where you have completely perfect information and you're always going to vote for the party that best matches your ideals.
And if one would be voted for the exact opposite party that you believe in.
Every time.
which may be possible, but it wasn't included into this model. And so they had this idea that based on demographic information, it looks like people who are less informed about what parties stand for, the more likely they were to be part of the traditional Democratic base. So, for example, single, poor black women were much less likely to be informed about what the parties held than white, rich males. This is based on survey information taken since the 70s, I think. And so their idea was, and the way that this model works, is that if the population is more informed, then Democratic or liberal parties would get more votes. Because what happens is that people who are usually part of the traditional Democratic base and that would want to vote democratically or liberally because they're more in line with their political beliefs tend to have less information and therefore make more mistakes in voting. Whereas people who are in the traditionally conservative base are more informed, therefore they make less mistakes, and therefore there's a bias towards the conservative side.
I feel like on top of the findings of this, there's you have to keep in mind that parties will utilize this basic information, so they could spread misinformation, and on top of that, they could... They don't need to worry about having such a cohesive policy if they think a lot of the voters are going to be uninformed anyway. So it sort of has its... Assuming you had perfect parties, imperfect information would be a problem. With imperfect parties, imperfect information becomes even more of a problem.
So you get in the States, again, because they provide so many examples of this kind of wrong thinking, Republicans promoting the idea that affordable health care is bad because it creates death panels which are going to kill your grandmother. Right, and of course that's very bad misinformation, but it's enough to lead an ill-informed voter to actually vote against their own self-interest.
Yeah, so basically anything that leads you into making a mistake and voting to a party that ultimately will not uphold your political beliefs is something that contributes to that higher probability of voting incorrectly. And they did a three-phase survey in which they presented people with this information and tested to make sure that they were actually using the information, which is a really nice touch, because often surveys sort of like, they provide the information, they look at the results and assume that the information made the difference. But this time they actually made sure that people were actually learning it and remembering it. And they did a follow-up after the second survey where they, you know, first survey, they give the information, check what their beliefs are. Second survey, they see if they have learned any of the information and test if it's changed their anything. And then they did another follow-up a couple weeks later to see if their voting preferences stayed after learning this new information. And they had nearly 900 initial respondents, and 340 people took all three phases, which is a really good sample size for a survey. And they basically found that people do learn the information. It was presented in the form of newspaper articles and letters to the editor and included controlled, the partisan's breakdown of what this party wants to do based on the last vote on this topic was blah, X versus X. And they found that people, when they get more information, tended to shift almost one full standard deviation towards more liberal points of view.
Again, because... Not everyone in our listening audience is a PhD in mathematics. One standard deviation means what?
It is, so 33% of any group of people falls within one standard deviation of the mean. So the mean is the average value, the average person, and on either side of that, there's 33% on one side and 33% on the other, and that's one standard deviation to the right, one standard deviation to the left. So most people fall within one standard deviation of the mean. It is a quite a large proportion of the population. So, you know, even giving them this basic kind of information in the form of letters to the editor shifted people one whole standard deviation. So if they were undecided voter in the middle, they would shift pretty much into the liberal camp. If they were a Republican voter, they would have shifted into the independent or undecided camp.
So basically in Canada, conservatives lose based on the current like numbers.
if they get more information. Yeah. So yeah, the other really nice thing is that it lasted weeks. It lasted weeks after they got the information, and this kind of as you said, this information would change election results.
Well, you know, speaking of informing our electorate, another thing that I thought we would now transgress into, thank you, Rob, for your enlightening information on that, is there's been a lot of talk about governments, how governments are formed in Canada and all that. It became an issue thanks to Harper's initial fear-mongering, I'm going to call it fear-mongering, about coalition governments and the pushback about who gets actually to form. So I thought I'd do a quick primer onto actually how governments are formed in Canada and how they are unformed. I guess I can use that term.
As far as I understand it, it's pretty Byzantine and complex.
In some ways, it's pretty simple. So, you know, how are governments formed in Canada? After an election, the government general asks the leader of the party with the largest number of seats if he believes he can secure the confidence of Parliament. It's an important thing, this idea of confidence of Parliament. Obviously, if it's a majority party, it's won more than half the seats in Parliament, and that's how you determine whether it's got the confidence or not. It's kind of a given that he can get this confidence vote. However, in a minority situation, some negotiations may have to take place before a positive answer can be given. In a lot of other countries, this happens all the time. I mean, England right now has a coalition government, which is sort of similar. Australia, Israel, a number of countries, you know, Belgium. I don't think Belgium yet has a government formed yet because it is massively diverse in its tensions. But again, you know, if it can't secure the confidence of the parliament, it doesn't get it. When it can't, the government general can go and ask the runners up, either the second or third party, do you think you can attain this particular goal? And if they think they can, then they can. Of course, now, once you've formed a government, how do you get rid of it? There are essentially three mechanisms.
Bloody revolution.
Four mechanisms.
I heard the English tried to blow up Parliament once.
Yeah, well, remember the 4th of November?
Fifth.
Sorry.
Clearly you didn't remember.
Right. Actually, well, and as I just said, so in this particular situation where, you know, no one party can gain a complete confidence majority, then they form either a coalition or a minority government. Now, what exactly does that mean? Well, a minority government is where one party forms a government, as in all the ministers, the prime minister, everything is from one party, and they have the support of other parties so as to maintain the confidence. And there are confidence votes, budgets equate to a confidence vote. And as long as they can maintain that confidence, they remain the government.
It should be mentioned that the party that forms government can choose to make almost anything a confidence vote if it wants to. It doesn't have to just be budget. So oftentimes they'll use that as sort of a bullying mechanism to get people to vote for what they want.
Exactly. And of course, the other one is a coalition government, is where you have two or more parties who actually form the government, and they are, if in themselves or with the support of a third or fourth party, able to maintain the confidence. For example, this was something that Harper had proposed in 2004, and the most recent one in 2008, which has been getting a lot of press, where the NDP and Liberals were going to form a split ministry where 18 ministers were going to be Liberal and 6 were going to be NDP, and the Bloc said, we will offer our support to maintain the confidence. They weren't actually part of the government, but that was how it went on. So now that you have your government, how do you get rid of it? As I say, there are three plus one mechanisms for getting rid of the government. Firstly, of course, in our Constitution, the government cannot hold power for longer than 5 years. Once you hit the fifth year from the call of the last election, there has to be an election by our Constitution.
Barring war.
Actually, no, I think it's there's not an exception for war. In our new this is our new Constitution.
Pretty sure you're wrong, but I don't have it in front of me.
Well, remember, okay, that the Constitution is post-war.
Yes, but I still believe there's an exception in there for that.
Okay.
We'll look and post it on the blog.
If someone knows that, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
So that's one way. Another way, of course, is under parliamentary rules, the Prime Minister can ask the Governor General to dissolve Parliament. But the Governor General, of course, as the representative of our head of our state, can say no. This was actually a precedent set in 1926 when William Lyon Mackenzie asked the Governor General to dissolve Parliament, and then Governor General Lord Byng refused and gave the Conservatives a chance.
Wasn't Mackenzie Prime Minister for something like 30 years?
Yeah, off and on. He's had quite a number. I think he's had the most
terms,
although yeah, not the longest consecutive term, because he lost power. Well, for example, he lost power for about a week when the Conservatives tried to take over. And of course, he used the whole Byng affair as a platform to say, vote for us because look what the Queen's trying to do to us. And even though he had a lot of other issues going on at the time, they all got sidetracked by the Lord Byng affair. And as I mentioned, said before, sort of Paul Martin had a minority situation in 2004 where Harper tried to draft an agreement to the opposition parties to do that. 2008, same thing. So again, you can go to the Governor General and ask to dissolve the government. The Governor General can either accept or refuse. And if it refuses, can go to the number two or three party and say, listen, they don't think they can maintain the confidence of Parliament. Maybe you can. And of course, lastly, and this is sort of the current situation we have, the government may just simply lose the confidence of the Parliament, and there is a vote that is held, on purpose or not, as Daniel pointed out, the government can make anything a confidence vote, and if it doesn't have the confidence of the Parliament, then Parliament is deemed dissolved. One thing I find quite interesting is that when last time we had this sort of issue of a government falling by a non-confidence vote, it was Harper did a very unusual thing.
He prorogued Parliament.
Which, to be fair, governments have been proroguing Parliament since day one, right? It traditionally is a time when you go back to your constituency and you talk to your constituents and you say, hey, how things are going, right? And it's sort of like, you know, one session of government ends, and then a new one starts up, usually 6 months to a year later, depending on, 6 months or a few months later, depending on the time period. But everything that was on the docket before is deemed dissolved, and everything starts fresh without there actually being an election. As I mentioned, normally a session will last, like I say, 6 months to a year. That's normally how long each session lasts. And most modern governments will have anywhere from 2 to 4 sessions in their term, depending on how long they're in there. But the last one, which made it very noteworthy and why it was such in the press, is Harper actually set 2 records with it. First, he had the shortest session in history for a government. It was only 17 days. And he also had
The earliest call for prorogation.
Thank you. After election of only 51 days, which made everyone say, well, that seems pretty fishy. And it was. It was a political maneuver.
A lot of people have been calling him out as doing things like this and calling against the coalitions and things like that as sort of meddling with the affairs of democracy.
Now, to be fair, and everyone knows how much I love Harper, he's not, again, the first one to use prorogation in this particular matter. William Lyon Mackenzie, Johnny MacDonald had done it when there was a big
the crazy old drunk.
Research into scandals. Actually, even John Chrétien, in an attempt to sidetrack the sponsorship scandal, prorogued Parliament, trying to avoid that. Ironically enough, at that time, Governor General stepped in, another time Parliamentary Secretary stepped in, and continued the investigations, even though government technically was out of session, so that they couldn't use it as sort of this hot potato. And remember, Harper did it because he was trying to sidestep at the time Canadian misdeeds in Afghanistan. So, again, political hot potato, not unique, although perhaps just as dubious.
The Canadian system is very different from other democracies in that there are a lot of weird loopholes built into our system because of the Governor General and others. I mean, there have been cases where a coalition was formed not by the opposition parties, but by half of the ruling party and half of the opposition party. The conscription crisis in Canada was formed by hawkish liberals and I believe the ruling conservative government. So, I mean, you do get very odd, unique situations that happen really only in this kind of democracy, not sort of a Jeffersonian democracy like the United States have.
Well, you even get some other interesting things, too. A lot of people think that they're voting for Prime Minister of Canada. Well, technically, in our Constitution, there is no such thing as a Prime Minister in Canada, right? The Constitution does make reference to a Prime Minister who is responsible for organizing constitutional conferences. But with the exception of that particular mention, there is no definition as to who or what a Prime Minister is. And in fact, in our history, we've had 2 Prime Ministers who weren't actually members of Parliament. John Abbott and Mackenzie Bowell were both actually senators at the time when they became that. And again, according to our laws, the Prime Minister, if he loses his seat in an election but his party still has maintained the majority, still technically is Prime Minister. And where we get around that is we don't rely so much on the Constitution like the Americans do, which are really big in the legalese, but we use constitutional conventions. So although technically, there is no position of Parliament. The PMO's office is very well defined by historical precedent, and that's sort of how we get around that particular issue.
Yeah, the whole executive branch in Canadian government is basically all convention. like cabinet ministers have at many times not been members of parliament either. So it's all sort of, it's not written in stone as Harper or some other people like to tell you. It is sort of flexible based on what the Canadian people will allow.
Exactly.
That's really weird.
Well, that's why, I mean, one of the things that sometimes even an election issue is how big is the cabinet, because no position in the cabinet, including the PM, is actually really defined anywhere.
Parliamentary reform is always an election issue.
It is. Yeah. And, of course, now this leads us up to sort of the last thing I wanted to cover quickly, because we're running out of time, is exactly why are we in this particular election itself? Now, of course, the Conservatives said, well, we're here because, quote-unquote, the three political parties saw an opportunity to go after the government. Whereas the Liberals say, well, and actually I laughed when I read this quote, Canadians know exactly why we're having an election. We're having an election because the Harper government didn't tell Parliament the truth about budget cost and a number of other issues. As it turns out, the actual cause, the mechanism for which the government fell, was that the Conservative government was found guilty of contempt of Parliament.
Just fully anecdotal evidence in support of the thesis that uninformed voters are biased to vote Conservative. Nearly everyone I've talked to that didn't know that Harper and the cons had indeed lied to Parliament were also Harper supporters.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it is a thing. I mean, like Harper calls it a so-called motion, so-called contempt of motion. But if you look into it, there was the Oda Kairos funding affair, in which the government said, a number of ministers had said that, you know, the reason why this group didn't get its funding is because it didn't meet CETA requirements. And CETA said, no, actually, it did meet CETA requirements. And the reason why it wasn't was the minister just said, no, we don't agree with it for political or whatever reasons, which is completely within the rights of the government. The minister does have complete right to veto any funding it gives. But the fact that it had repeatedly lied to Parliament was the thing. In fact, the Speaker of the House said, any reasonable person confronted with what appears to have transpired would necessarily be extremely concerned, if not shocked. This also goes with the idea that, and we're hearing this today about the funding of the jets, that the government, the parliamentary committees, and these parliamentary committees have a lot more power now than they do normally, because we do have a minority situation where the government of the day can't just push through things because they no longer have a majority on these committees, because the committees are themselves proportional to the representation in Parliament. So the committees were asking for, you know, concrete numbers as far as the costs are going to be about the building of new prisons and all that, you know, the crime bill that Harper's gone through, the jet fighters among corporate tax rates. And at first the government said, well, no, it's executive privilege. We don't have to tell you this. You know, who do you think you are? And it's like, well,
who do you think you are?
You're the people's representatives. And then they've been stonewalling. And that was actually the second sort of aspect of why the government was found in contempt of Parliament. So, again, it's very interesting how people get misled by particular things. Obviously, I have a slight bias in my opinion here.
You know, I mean, the thing is, too, a lot of people that I've talked about this think this is old-fashioned, you know, political mudslinging. But this is actually a real thing. This is the contempt of Parliament. It's not just, you know, cocked up by Liberal supporters to try to make the Conservatives look like jerks. This really actually happened. And if it happened to the Liberals, you know, we'd be saying the exact same thing. This is contempt.
But Ethan, ask me, how many times have a government been found in contempt in Canadian history?
As far as I know, this is the first time.
First time it's ever happened. And I cannot
understand.
Have there
always been provisions for finding governments in contempt?
Yeah, contempt of, it's one of the things that's been brought over from the British, is if you violate MPs' privilege, and one of the ways to violate that is to lie to Parliament, then you are found in contempt of Parliament. Now, usually when this sort of thing arises, when someone, like I say, it's not like Bev Oda was the first person to lie to Parliament. It has happened before. But usually you're like, oh, shit, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. You know, here's the information, and this is how it happened. And there's a lot of... But
well, they just resign or something.
And usually resignation is implied. But one of the different things, and this is why it's... should be more of an issue, is just the whole tone of the way our government is going very much to, we are here to rule you, and you just, you know, one of the things that annoys me so much, I've been hearing about, is people say, oh, we're going to the polls again, and we have to vote again. And I'm going, well, would you prefer if you never had to vote? Would that, because if you want that, My name is Dawn. Vote for me once, and I will guarantee you'll never have to vote again. Right? No, but no. Ethan's pointing out to a very interesting thing is that because of our political cycle, we tend to get sidetracked by minor, well, maybe not minor issues, but what are traditional political issues. But we're missing an entirely new layer that's gone on top of this. Let us not forget that another thing, too, that's been involved in this is that the Conservative Party has been charged with, and I think convicted, of electioneering fraud, right? I mean, they subverted our election process with their in-and-out scandal in the last election. And why aren't people saying this? I mean, if you say it and you forgive them for one reason, great. But nobody's talking about this. They're sitting there saying, you know, why don't we... they're giving funding to volunteer fire departments, which is great. I'm sure that volunteer firemen deserve a nice tax break. But seriously, we are on such a different level of badness that I cannot believe that people are not upset. I mean, even when Ignatieff, who tried, and maybe this is a bit of a tone on how effective a speaker he is, he came out in one of his speeches and he says, I don't understand why there isn't more rage in this country for the way this particular government is run, right? I mean, if you're a conservative and you like the conservative values, great. There's a valuable debate to be had into how this should be broken down. But there's a bigger issue out here. And
it turns out that if informed voters don't vote conservative, then it's a vested interest for the cons to prevent information like that from spreading and being used.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. Let's go to our skeptical highlights. I have a highlight that's coming up on Wednesday, April 27th. There's a public lecture called There Is No Link Between Immunizations and Autism, The Facts You Need to Know. And it's at 1489 McRae Avenue, which is over by 16th and Granville here in Vancouver. It costs $30, but that includes refreshments and food. Seating is limited, so you have to register in advance by emailing edutalksseminars@gmail.com, and we'll have it on our show notes.
And I've got a public lecture about the evolution of the universe at UBC. It's Sunday, May 1st at 2:30 p.m. to 4 p.m. Theoretical Professor John Ellis of King's College London, UK. Maybe he came out with you, Rob, and you didn't even notice. He will be answering Gagan's questions to particle physics. Where do we come from? Who are we? And where are we going? John Ellis is a frequent public lecturer on evolution of the universe, the Big Bang, the present and future of fundamental particle physics, and related topics. He's an advocate for experimental probes into supersymmetry, quantum gravity, and string theory. Topics so much simpler than what we've been talking about today.
Absolutely. One just final little announcement. Thursday, April 28th is Skeptics in the Pub in Richmond at Legends Pub, which is only a few minutes away from the Breakhouse SkyTrain station in Richmond Center. Come on out for a couple drinks and some good company.
I also think that wasn't Craig Venter coming to talk about synthetic biology at the Vogue sometime soon?
Tickets are sold out unless you've reserved them.
Oh, well, you know, I'm
you
going to that.
You might be able to line up. I don't know.
Well, I already reserved my tickets, so yay me.
And technically, I think it's May 4th or something, so it's...
you'll hear about it next week.
Yeah. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a very good evening.
And this is Daniel saying remember to vote if you're Canadian.
Yes, if you're not Canadian,
twice.
Don't vote. So long, folks.